Stop me if you've heard this one before, all right? Warren Buffett, Jamie Dimon, and Jeff Bezos walk into a bar and come out running a healthcare company. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, January 30th. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You could call them strange bedfellows, I suppose, but Warren Buffett, Jamie Dimon, and Jeff Bezos of Berkshire Hathaway, JPMorgan Chase, and Amazon in that order have at least this in common. Healthcare was clearly making them crazy. It was probably costing them money and not doing their combined 1 million employees as much good as it should. So since they can, they are going to do something about it, starting a company to offer their workers healthcare, quote, free from profit-making incentives and constraints. We've got Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein live on the phone from our help desk at WHYY to walk us through this thing. Hey, Dan.
Hey, Kai.
So give me the skinny here. What and how are these three men trying to do here?
So what they're trying to do, they're fed up, Kai, like you talked about. These guys are seeing that they're paying a lot of money. They're not getting a lot of quality for what they're paying for in terms of the outcomes of their workforce, the health of their workforce. And then really, the companies have this reputation for innovation, and they think that they can do something better. What that is really they think they are going to be able to spend less money and get better outcomes for their workers.
One of the things that got talked about a lot in the Affordable Care Act debate was this idea of bending the cost curve. It turns out, of course, that Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, didn't bend the cost curve. It didn't lower healthcare costs. It was mostly an insurance program. How are these three, do you think, going to try to get that done? Because it's an intractable problem, right?
Yeah, no, exactly. You know, I think that what they're trying to do here is they're going to have to figure out a way to cut back on care. But Kai, really, part of why this is such a hard problem to solve is what do you cut back on? It sounds easy to do that, but really, at the end of the day, when you sort of limit the options that a worker has, it means, you know what, maybe that guy who'd been getting care from that oncologist can no longer get that oncologist, because the reality is there are a lot of providers out there who are sort of mediocre quality providers but are charging a premium, and these companies are going to have to try to figure out who do we eliminate from the list of care that we offer to our workers.
One of the things that has been bandied about in the conversation today about this company, and we should say it is still conceptual, right? There's no actual company. There's no formal plan. But much speculation has been given to the idea of technology as a game changer here. Jeff Bezos knows a little something about that. Talk to me about how that might help.
So I think technology is potentially a player here, but we don't have these details. And I think really, I was talking to a couple of sources about this. I think the reality is that you have to do some of this sort of pre-shopping for your workforce, right? You have to figure out who are the people, who are the hospitals my workers shouldn't go to anymore. And maybe technology can help you figure out where to shop and where not to shop. I think another option here, and this isn't exactly technology, but it's identifying who your sickest workers are, Kyla. Sometimes they're called the 550, the 5% of workers who are responsible for 50% of the costs, and identifying them and trying to shower them with enough care that they don't go to the hospital anymore. That's the kind of thing that could save them money.
Dan Gorenstein at the Health Desk at WHYY in Philadelphia talking about the plan today by Messrs. Dimon, Buffett, and Bezos on healthcare. Dan, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
Healthcare companies got whacked on that news, as you might imagine, helped drag the broader markets lower as well. Details, numbers, when we get there. Janet Yellen is presiding over her last Federal Open Market Committee meeting this week. Today and tomorrow, not much indication, by the way, that they are going to raise rates. Jay Powell takes over this weekend as chair of the Fed. But we are going to send Chair Yellen off with a special variation of our long-running game show, What is Janet Yellen Thinking in Five Words or Less? Not really so much what she's thinking, but a response to her critics who openly doubted her strategy on basically everything in the wake of the financial crisis. So here are the words. There are four of them. Janet Yellen was right. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports on Janet Yellen's economic legacy.
The Federal Reserve has two goals, low unemployment and stable inflation. Janet Yellen managed to achieve both.
Pretty good steering of the economy towards your objective.
Ann Owen is an economist at Hamilton College. Inflation is now hovering right around the Fed's goal of 2%. Unemployment, just above 4%. The professor's grade for Yellen?
I would give her an A.
But Yellen wasn't old school. She wasn't overly focused on inflation numbers and economic theory like some of her predecessors. Former Fed economist Bill Nelson is now at the Clearinghouse, a trade group for banks.
Rather than thinking about the economy in the abstract, she was very conscious of the fact that the decisions had human consequences.
Yellen was worried about people, about jobs. She also had to deal with lots of critics who worried about her. It started before she took over as Fed chair in 2014. Here's Republican Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky at her confirmation hearing.
The Federal Reserve's answer to economic crisis has long been simply to print more money, or what they call quantitative easing.
For Paul, that approach would create a problem, overstimulating the economy. For Yellen, it was the solution, and she stuck with it, even as the criticism got louder from conservative economists like J.W. Verrett of George Mason University, who said her policies were stalling the economy.
Banks weren't lending enough because rates were too low for too long.
Yellen officially steps down at the end of this week, and after all of her success, she'll become the first Fed chair in decades not to be reappointed to a second term. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
When the president steps up to give his State of the Union tonight, we are going to hear about the economy, about companies bringing money back from overseas, we're going to hear about trade deals, and we are going to hear about immigration. The White House has offered what it calls a framework for a deal on DACA, which is going to include, in part, a significant reduction in legal immigration. By one estimate, the plan would cut the number of legal immigrants to this country by 22 million people over the next 50 years. And that, ladies and gentlemen, makes it a labor market story. Marketplace's Amy Scott has it.
The plan would cut the number of legal immigrants by around 500,000 people a year from current levels. Daniel Costa is with the Economic Policy Institute.
Not all of them were workers, but if they were, it'd be about 0.3% of the U.S. workforce.
So, not much. But even a small dip in the labor pool has employers worried. William Dunkelberg is chief economist with the National Federation of Independent Business. He says small employers are more concerned about filling jobs than taxes or regulatory costs these days.
If you look at construction, almost 50% have a job opening they can't fill. In manufacturing, 40%.
The argument for cutting immigration is that a smaller labor pool would force employers to pay Americans higher wages to fill those jobs. Jennifer Hunt is an economics professor at Rutgers. She says research has shown immigration doesn't change wages for most workers.
It will help native-born high school dropouts, but they represent about 8% of the native workforce. So it's worth remembering what a small minority they are.
Longer term, Hunt says a reduction in immigrants could hurt innovation. Fewer young people would pay into Social Security and Medicare. But EPI's Daniel Costa says the economic effects would be small.
It may hurt growth a little bit. It may hurt productivity a little bit. But overall, the macro impact isn't going to be huge. We'll just have a slightly smaller economy.
Not exactly the message President Trump wants to convey in his big moment tonight. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Okay, an interview now about bots, social media bots. You've heard of them, right? Automated accounts, sometimes useful, but often completely fake or based on stolen social media identities that are, frankly, rampant on Twitter and Facebook, even on LinkedIn as well. They can retweet or like or just sit there adding to somebody's somehow all-important follower count. And it turns out those bots are commodities that can be bought and sold easily, by the way, by anybody. And, not shockingly at all, turns out, it's all about the money. Nick Confessori is an investigative reporter at the New York Times. He shared the byline on the story in the paper this past weekend. Nick, welcome to the program.
It's good to be here, Kai.
There is an amazing statistic in this piece. Somebody with like 100,000 followers gets X amount of dollars for an endorsing tweet, and somebody with a million followers gets like some multiple thereof. I mean, it's crazy.
That's correct. So there's a data from Captivate, which is an influencer agency, and they provide this data to us. So the current market rates roughly, if you have 100,000 followers, you might get $2,000 for a promotional tweet. If you have 1 million followers, you can earn $20,000. But guess what? You can buy that 1 million followers for just $2,000. So it really pays for itself quite quickly if you can fool the advertisers who are paying you.
Should it happen that I wanted to go out and buy myself 1 million followers, which for the record, I don't want and have not done, there's a company you talk about who will happily provide me. Tell me about that.
That's true. So if you go on Google and search for how do I buy followers, you'll come across a company called Davumi. They can sell you the appearance of influence and reach, and they can sell you retweets and followers on Twitter, and that's a big business for them. In the last few years, I believe that they have made $2 million just from selling Twitter followers.
Interestingly enough, in this piece, some of the folks who are buying followers, Kathy Ireland and John Leguizamo and many others, they back off or get skittish as soon as you said to them, why are you doing this?
That's right. Look, we contacted or tried to contact almost every person who is a client of note of this company. Some of them were very forthright. James Cracknell, who's a British Olympian, said, look, I bought them. It was stupid. I feel rotten about it. You know, I don't want to be followed by fake people. I wouldn't do it again. You had people who never returned my phone calls or my emails, like Michael Dell, the computer billionaire. He bought 100,000 wow. followers. Kathy Ireland, it was an employee of her marketing agency who bought them. She and her representatives claim that she did not authorize these purchases. But look, most of her follower account is synthetic, and she is out there as a brand ambassador on Twitter for all these companies that pay her to be influential on social media.
One more just in the world of journalism. Richard Roper at the Chicago Sun-Times. The paper announced, yesterday after your piece was published, that they're not going to publish any more of his columns until they get to the bottom of this him buying followers thing.
That's right. Richard Roper was a client of this company, Davumi. We see that he made purchases from the company over a few months or a year, I believe. So look, even a successful film critic is going to be a person who looks around and says, you know, I should have more influence on social media. I should have more followers. And if I can't get them the old-fashioned way, I'll obtain them the really old-fashioned way, which is to buy them.
Twitter says what about bots and how they are used and abused in this follower chase?
Well, Twitter has an interesting response here. First of all, it's actually against Twitter's terms of service to buy followers or buy engagement. So it's against the rules. But I think they have an issue. You can buy followers for anybody, Kai. I could go buy 1 million followers for you in the next 10 minutes.
Ooh.
And you would get them and have no control over it. So one issue for Twitter is they can't always be sure who made the purchase. And it's fascinating, right? There's like a whole system here that they haven't really had a handle on.
It's completely nutty. And the idea that you can buy followers from me, and once again, don't. But the idea that you could is first of all, bananas. But doesn't it give lie to this whole social media influencers and all of that stuff? Isn't it just a sham now?
I think a lot of it is a sham. The advertising agencies and the marketing agencies and then the new influencer agencies will tell you, well, we have accountability. We have ways of checking. We measured engagement, how many people are actually responding. But you know what? You can buy the engagement too.
Of course.
And most of these agencies, I'm sure they're trying their best, but I don't think that they have many tools beyond what the social media companies provide them with, which is not much. Huh. These social media platforms are where commerce and politics are taking place increasingly, and they are black boxes. They are controlled by private companies. They are exempt from the First Amendment, and no one knows how they work except the people who own them.
Nick Conversori is an investigative reporter for The New York Times. His most recent piece with a bunch of other people at The Times, including, I will tell you what, some grade A digital graphics and design folks. It's amazing online. Check it out. It's called The Follower Factory. Nick, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Guy.
Coming up.
What is good about this type of vehicle is we are able to get into areas where traditional large delivery vehicles are prohibited.
The smartest way to get your package and yourself, really, all the way home. First, though, let's do the numbers. Tell you what, I was expecting the wah-wah trombones. I'm just saying. Dow off 362 points today, 1 3/10%. That's wah-wah recipe, I'll tell you that. 26,076 on the blue chips. NASDAQ off 64 points, about 8/10%, 7,402. S&P 500 off 31 points, 1%, 28-22 there. Told you about healthcare stocks. Aetna, the insurance company, set to be bought by the pharmacy chain CVS, saw shares dip 3%. You say that 10 times fast. Saw shares dip. CVS off 4.1%. Walgreens down 5.1%. Pfizer, the drug maker, down 3.1% today. Amazon up 1.4% today. J.P. Morgan Chase down 9.1%. Berkshire Hathaway declined about 0.1%, so kind of a wash there. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note, I'm telling you, pay attention, 2.72% today. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We are going to go to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania now. Not the Pittsburgh of today, but the city as it was near the middle of the last century. When for just a couple of decades, it was the center of an amazing amount of change and innovation, home to some of the most influential musicians, writers, and sports figures of Black America. How that happened and then what happened is the subject of a new book by journalist Mark Whitaker. It's called Smoketown, the Untold Story of the Other Great Black Renaissance. Mark, thanks for coming on.
Hi, Kai. How are you?
I'm well. We should say at the outset here, you are a Pennsylvania guy, mostly Philadelphia, though, grown up. But you had family in Pittsburgh and you went back a lot?
My dad grew up in Pittsburgh, and he had moved away. I was born, as you say, outside of Philadelphia. But I used to go and visit every year. My grandparents were still there. They were undertakers.
Oh, wow.
My grandfather at a certain point suffered a stroke, and my grandmother took over the business. But, you know, if you visited Pittsburgh in that era, you would have never known that just 20 years earlier, it was one of the most vibrant and influential Black communities in all of America.
It is an amazing story that you tell in this book for a couple of reasons. One is the relatively brief period of time, which, as you write, Black Pittsburgh was so dynamic, but also the people and the things that came out of there, right? I mean, Lena Horne and Billy Strayhorn in music, August Wilson, the Negro Leagues in baseball. There was so much. The Pittsburgh Courier, the newspaper. There was so much. It's almost it's a sense of history that you can't quite wrap your brain around.
Well, you know, when I was working on this book, I would tell people that I'm working on a book on the legacy of Black Pittsburgh, and then I would say, what it really is a story of Black history in the middle of the 20th century, because every major story in Black history passed through Pittsburgh. You had swing and the birth of bebop, Joe Louis. You had the Jackie Robinson story and the Negro Leagues. But you also had huge political influence. It was really in Pittsburgh, thanks to the Courier, that led the migration of the Black vote from the Republican Party to the Democratic Party in 1932.
The thing that jumps out at you at this, as you read this book, is how brief this moment in time was. It was basically like 30 years, 20s to the 50s, right? So what happened? How did it disappear?
So I would say that the three major factors that contributed to the decline, and it was very fast. Like a lot of northern cities where Black folks had migrated, once the industries that had attracted them started to go in decline, white folks started moving out of the city, moved to the suburbs. Black folks were stuck there. It's a sad, familiar story. In Pittsburgh, there was also the factor of urban renewal, which was particularly dramatic in Pittsburgh. And then the third factor, which gets less attention, is what you could call sort of Black brain drain, that with the civil rights movement and affirmative action and so forth, that era, talented, ambitious Black folks like my father were able to leave Pittsburgh to go to college and have careers outside of Pittsburgh, and they never came back. So at precisely the point where these black neighborhoods in Pittsburgh needed leadership. They were losing it to the wider world.
So Pittsburgh today, right? I mean, it's moved past the whole, steel industry historical context, right? And it's, I mean, Uber's there doing self-driving cars, and Pittsburgh's on the short list for Amazon's second headquarters. And so I guess the question is, how do you gauge the odds of success of present-day African-Americans in the future economics of Pittsburgh, right? Are they going to be able to
get back? As you say, Pittsburgh is undergoing yet another broader renaissance. The black neighborhoods have not yet. But I'm hoping that part of that, learning this story, will give both black folks in the city, but also, you know, business and political leaders a sense of pride in the past and hope that, you know, perhaps some of it can be brought back.
It's a history of Pittsburgh back in the day. It's called Smoketown by Mark Whitaker. Mark, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
We've put some of the cool old pictures from Mark's book on our Instagram. We are at Marketplace APN. Sometimes solving complicated problems leads to some interesting solutions. There's a thing in logistics called the last mile problem. You hear it in telecommunications a lot, getting broadband from the distribution hub to your house. But last mile logistics are an issue for package delivery companies, too, and increasingly public transportation agencies who want to get their passengers all the way home. From WABE in Atlanta, Amy Kiley reports public transit and package delivery companies are working on it separately, but they're coming up with similar solutions.
I tackle my last mile problem by taking the bus. It stops right outside my apartment.
Have a good day.
Thank you.
Have a good day.
But what about people who don't live along a bus route or who live on side roads that prohibit all large vehicles, even delivery trucks? I meet Metro Atlanta Rapid Transit Authority's Ben Limmer at a local transit station and ask him.
MARTA is looking at more innovative solutions to help route some of our community circulator buses.
Those are smaller buses, kind of like airport shuttles. Some run on fixed routes, and some will operate like ride shares.
These would be more like a Uber or Lyft type technology.
MARTA already partners with those companies. Now it plans to launch its own version of ride sharing this year. It's called a Flexible Transit Pilot Program. MARTA got a private grant for that, but the Federal Transit Administration has also given out grant money to spur this kind of innovation nationwide. Speaking of new ideas, Limmer and I are staring at another one.
But also at this station, you have access to the city's Relay Bike Share, where you can rent a bike either by the hour or by the day.
Bikes solve a big last-mile puzzle, how to get people and packages into places large vehicles can't go. In fact, a few miles north at the headquarters for the United Parcel Service, right in the UPS lobby, is a huge electric tricycle. On top of the two wheels and back is a compartment for packages that makes the bike look like a mini UPS truck. Standing next to it is Ed Rogers. He's a top engineer with UPS who works on the last mile problem.
So what is good about this type of vehicle is we are able to get into areas where traditional large delivery vehicles are prohibited.
So UPS created its own elaborate computer program. It's the same idea as the MARTA app, but much more complicated. It's called ORION, which stands for On-Road Integrated Optimization and Navigation System. Every day, for every UPS driver, it calculates more than a trillion possible routes. Then it picks the best one.
At UPS, we shave a mile off of every route across the U.S. every day, $50 million savings. It adds up.
It took more than 10 years to develop ORION. Rogers won't tell me how much it cost UPS, but he does say it was worth it. So how are all these different organizations coming up with similar last-mile solutions?
They would be industrial and systems engineers. They would be computer information systems analysts, writing the code, writing the algorithms.
Walter Wallace runs the Global Logistics Roundtable at Georgia State University. He says all those jobs fall under a field called telematics. It basically involves getting as much information as possible, analyzing the numbers, and then using them to travel efficiently. That work is in high demand.
It's a complicated, complex world. But today's mandate is analytics. It's no longer an option.
That's true whether sending a package or sending people home on a bus. In Atlanta, I'm Amy Kiley for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today. You know how in-flight Wi-Fi is extremely expensive to be kind? Well, get this. Bloomberg reports today the cost of putting newer and better Wi-Fi gear on airplanes has fallen so much that more carriers are installing it. There is a better than 80% chance your domestic flight in this country is going to have internet connectivity. Now, about the cost. Yeah, it's not going down because profits. And yes, I understand it sounds crazy to complain about connectivity when you're 35,000 feet up in the air in a sealed aluminum tube, but yeah. Okay, we're done. The Dow, without any wah-wah trombones, off 362 points today, about 1.3%. NASDAQ off 64 points, 0.8%. S&P 500 down 31, about 1%. Our digital team includes Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. Ben Heathcote does video for us. Sarah Muti is our executive director of digital. Sitar Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.